Hey, everyone. This is 372 pages. We'll never get back. I am Michael J. Nelson. Connor is here, too. Connor, how are you?
I'm good, Mike. I had a fun trip, not this weekend, but the last one, right after we just recorded, the same day. I flew out to Reno, Nevada for a friend's bachelor party. And it was one of those, like, you know, flights that gets in at like 2 a.m. Eastern time. So I was, you know, exhausted the whole time. But it was also a JetBlue flight, so there was TV on it the whole way.
Oh, nice. I've never done the JetBlue.
Oh, it's, yeah, it's, you know, they didn't kill anyone's dog. They didn't drag anyone off the plane bleeding. So it was disappointing in that respect. But they did have TV. So as I was drifting off, doing the whole like nod thing, just because it was late my time, I happened to glance over at what the guy next to me was watching, and saw that Sean Penn was on Late Night with Jimmy Kimmel. And it was that sort of like that state of mind where it's like, am I really seeing this? Like, this is a little on the nose life. But he was on there to promote the paperback release of Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff.
So the thing that we mused about before your trip, it came true. The person next to you, were they elbowing you and going, must love this.
I didn't have the book out. I hadn't been reading it, so there was no opportunity for that. But I still fell back asleep then, so I didn't have a chance to know what he was talking about on the plane. But I assumed, you know, I gave him credit. I assumed he was coming out like, you know, snapping his fingers and making jokes with the band and sort of just entertaining everybody and doing some self-deprecating, takes to the audience.
Yeah, that kind of like Paul Newman used to go on Letterman and give the audience the double guns and do terrible jokes about the cats being, you know, where the hell are the singing cats? It was great. Yeah, so that kind of bon vivant kind of stuff.
Yeah, and even if you sort of like suspect that he's just putting on an air, you know, sure, but we all do that. We all, act differently when it's a performance. There's no reason to prolong pretending that he did any of that. It was one of the most like weird and dour talk show interviews that I had ever heard. It reminded me of like when my grandfather was sort of getting near the end and you would ask him a question and there'd just be that moment, a little bit of hang time before before he picked up on what you were talking to him about.
Right. We've all known those people who give you that 2 second gap. Maybe it's not even that long, but it seems like an eternity before they actually respond to you. You don't see the spark in their eyes. You're not getting anything back.
Yes, yes. And so maybe it's due to hearing, maybe it's the mental thing, but that's what the interview reminded me of. And there were times when Kimmel was a little game, like trying to, like he accused him of misspelling your title is grammatically incorrect. It should be Who Just Does Stuff. And Sean Penn
picked up on that, ran with it, did he?
Right. Yes, exactly. They just went back and forth and speculated, what if other book titles were grammatically incorrect? No, he just sort of like stared at him. And by the end, Jimmy Kimmel wasn't even fake laughing through the thing. But he sort of rambled in a way that reminded me of the Bob Crane patriotism to bring it up again. And the John Wayne sort of rambling speech he gave that there's a clip of in the 80s. But I pulled a clip from it just to sort of to hear the bon vivant nature of Sean Penn promoting his book, you know, in theory, trying to get people to read this book that he has written.
Yeah, I was going to cue it up like Kimmel for you. Now, do we have a clip of that? Can we go ahead and run that?
Yeah, I think we got a clip.
Oh, great. Okay, can we let's get my producer to run that right now. Here we go. This is
it is again a kind of, you know, you say you have to in your family. I would say that you know the struggle in today's world is you don't want to get, you want to be so skeptical. And it becomes very defensive. And I am so ludicrously so that then it's, for a reader, not for me writing it, but for a reader, I think very funny.
How is the audience not laugh rolling at that stuff?
Well, he's endorsing the book, which is very funny. He's not trying to be funny. But yeah, that's, you know. I mean, I imagine if you pulled your average Joe out of the audience, they might be a bit more prepared to discuss the works of Sean Penn than Sean Penn himself appears to be.
Wow, yeah. I'm sure his book promoter is like, why don't we cancel this this right. promotional tour. We'll get you know, the Bobo the Ape to do your promotion or something.
Right. But then so a listener sent us other clips that he had done, because he had done a book promo when it initially came out last year. So they listened to him do the book tour the last time and figured it would be a good idea to send him back out there again. And the last tour, I guess, people were sort of, one of the things they talked about was, so this book has come out and people seem to really hate it. And this listener sent us two different clips of talk shows, one a PBS interview and one a Conan interview, where he trots out the same sort of like defense to critics of his book.
I think we have a clip of that, don't we? Let's run that right now. Here we go. Here's Sean Penn. Mm-hmm.
And what I would say to anybody who's offended by this, because I took care to write a book that starts on page one and doesn't end till it ends. And if read fully and in context, what I would say is, I'm 57, my pool's heated, you can say anything you like.
So a lot to process there, but he wrote a book that starts on page one and doesn't end till it ends.
Pause for laugh.
Credit to him for that. And then he used that same line about him being 57 and his pool is heated in the PBS interview too. So that was sort of the online criticism where some guy's like, all right, well, you nerds can argue about Marvel Comics all you want. I've got my hot wife who's like, you know, and driving my sports car. So like,
yeah, it's the old he makes a lot more money than you thing when you criticize somebody. I wasn't okay. Yeah, that's most of the people in the world. Wow. Anyway, so that's all prelude to say that this show, what we do here on this podcast, is
right. We play clips of talk shows, and we are
reading through the works of books that we probably will not like, and to varying degrees, we have and have not liked them. And I'd just like to do an update on that real quick, because this book has moved the bar for me.
Wow.
Yeah. It's moved it quite a bit. It's shifted my perception probably of all things. Time itself, being, matter, existence, the meaning of life. So as I look back on the books that we have read, the Ernest Cline book, I now give an 8. I give
Which
a,
one?
The first one.
Ready Player One.
I give a 6 to Armada.
These are out of 10?
Yeah. And I'm going to give a 64 squares is a solid 10. I mean,
okay, sure, yeah, right.
And
it didn't sell as much as Armada, but
Eye of Argon, solid 10.
Wow, all right.
And this book, a 0.
Wow,
I am not enjoying this.
That's incredible.
How about you? I mean, you know, relatively, you don't have to give me all the numbers, but you know, as you look back on it. The other books were much more enjoyable than this.
I think so. I think that I would say during Ready Player One, I would record this and I would read more of Ready Player One, because I was so curious to see if there was any chance he pulled it off based on the reviews. So Armada, I don't think I was enthusiastic to keep reading it, but it did amuse me. And, you know, obviously Eye of Argon and 64 Squares amused the hell out of me. Like, that was... There were books I enjoyed. I found myself describing them to other people. I think that this is absolutely... And, you know, Tech War, I think, would be... I would put as a 4 on your scale.
Oh, yeah. I forgot Tech War. Yeah. I might go 5 or 6 on that comparatively. But, yeah.
But, yeah, this... I mean, it's more of a chore. It requires closer reading to make sure that I'm not, like, you know... missing anything that I could be then making fun of. It's harder to relate to other people just because there is so much less of a plot than what's going on. So it's, I don't think a 0 is unfair.
Yeah. Well, just don't Eustace Conway me, would you please, during the course of this podcast?
Exactly. We will get to that, I guess. But that was another thing where I read this section twice. And the second time I actually looked up who that was. And then I was underwhelmed when I discovered who it was.
Yeah. I resent every single having to look something up. I resent every one of them. And I'm reading on, I'm reading on a doc of doing. So the footnotes are all the way at the bottom. They're not on the page. And so I have to have the book next to me to pick it up, you know, like set my laptop down, go to the book and look at that because it's too hard to there's no hot link between the things, you know. So,
yeah.
And so I resent every single instance of having to do that. Like, I know this is not going to pay off, but I have to do it. I have to do my due diligence. So every single moment of that, yeah, is I resent it, which I did not with any of, you know, like reading Grignard or whatever.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the I don't think there is even a footnote on the Eustace Conway one. I might be wrong about that, but it required, you know, they discussed who he was in the book, but it required me to actually Wikipedia and find out who this guy was.
Yep. Same here. I had to do it.
but let's get to that.
Let's get to Station 10.
Station 10.
Ballad of a Broken Man.
Yeah. So I thought that it was a bold move to start pulling your station titles from you know, My Chemical Romance songs. But the Ballad of a Broken Man, I suppose, is Bob. He uses that as the type of article that he surmises Dave Coulier is writing about him. What's the guy's name? Kirby? Herbie Coulier?
Sidney? Oh,
yeah. Fortier? Anyway, yeah, something Coulier.
Spurley.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah, he is accusing Spurley Coulier of writing an article that's going to be about him, the Ballad of a Broken Man.
Right. And do we learn? I guess we don't learn during this reading if Spurley, first of all, if he's real, if he's actually right. I don't know. You get hints that Spurley's not actually an author or may not exist. I don't know.
Sure. Yes. But before that, We ponder, Bob wonders if at nearly 60, his already deepening wrinkles might at some point come to accumulate unabsorbed Nivea cream.
Yeah.
But it is a fleeting cerebration since he knows he could simply avoid the usage of cream, which had me worried for that time in between the period and the next sentence that he might get some accumulated unabsorbed Nivea cream. But our crafty narrator has found a way around that problem.
Yeah, I read those two sentences and said, you know, you simply couldn't have not written about this. Then we would have avoided it all together. But before that, though, it starts right away, the irritation, because he talks about the sun hitting his derma.
Yeah.
You know, take the thesaurus away from that guy, lock it up, don't ever let him. I mean, we all know the term derma and what it means, but you don't use it in that context. So him doing it is just, again, it's like vinegar in your eyes. Like, stop it. Stop doing that.
Was that wedged in for alliteration, was it? Or was
it wasn't
just
even, no. It was just like in the feeling of the sun hitting his derma.
And it's not even trying to be cool, like, you know, a dad boner, like top shelf margs or like time for a celebration. It's just, yeah. It's not a cool abbreviation.
Yeah, and then quickly after that, we're sheeple again. he gets, what is it, the masses of fans as happy as hustled, bustled, and rustled sheep. A country mm-hmm. without culture, nothing more than a shopping mall with a flag. Oh, you sheeple.
Yeah, he's and that's to criticize fans of entertainment. Mm-hmm. Bob, a.k.a. Sean Penn, I think he's really onto something because he, as far as I know, is the first person that's ever pointed out that the entertainment industry, like Hollywood movies, might not be concerned with artistic integrity.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's
onto something there.
He's blazing some turf here.
Yeah.
Or morality for that measure.
He's blazing something, but I don't know.
There was a really passage about that right before the sheeple accusation, but he says, Bob is sitting at the edge of his bed in those days, weaving and watching television movies themselves mostly made from the seasickness of misguided creative endeavor. And this was weird. I was reading and as I read The Seasickness of Misguided Creative Endeavor, the book Bob Honey actually set itself on fire, I believe, from the irony of what I had just read. So I had to order a new copy.
Wow, yeah, that'll happen.
But yeah, it's a the second sheeple was a bold move on his part.
It was, and he's not done with that either. we will be revisiting that. So Spurley shows up as all people do. He rings the doorbell and he's brandishing two popsicles.
Yes,
the recurring theme, the thing that you thought was a throwaway joke, has become he's drilled right down on this. His ex-wife runs an empire, of course, and so he's Cloutier is offering him his ex-wife's stuff, and he sits and slurpily slops. And I don't know if this association came to you. I just wondered immediately what he would do to a chili dog outside the Tasty Freeze. Yes.
Oh man, just slurpily sucking.
Yeah,
Jack and Diane are like, please, you know, Jack is trying to put his hands behind my knees here, and we can't even focus on that because this horrible noise you're making.
But it reminds him of his ex-wife, and what do you think that is? That a good association? Do you think he thinks fondly of the way his wife would cutely and delicately go after her ice cream? No, she made similarly slopping sounds made by the woman who graces its package.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
So this was eye opening for me because he talked about her having an ice cream truck, but I assumed that just meant she was, you know, buying good humor fudgesicles and, you know, ice creams that look like Donald Duck or whatever. But evidently she is making her own ice cream and it has its own packaging. He says that Cloutier's, the popsicles are the Baron Broad's brew. So they're homemade. And then his ex-wife's salacious smiling face is brandished on their wrappers.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's Betty Crocker or whatever, you know.
Yeah, Orville Redenbacher of ice cream. She's Ben and Jerry.
Yeah, and she has armies of the trucks because he says he can't go anywhere without hearing that sound. So apparently the entire city is covered with the noise of her at all places, no matter where you are. Because it comes up a lot. He mentions that he's haunted by the music constantly. So yeah, and she drives her truck, as we noted in last episode. She drives one of the trucks as well.
So. Yes. Right. Yeah. She's like an undercover CEO. But so that was a surprise. It must take a lot to, you know, you see those like homemade ice cream makers or that type of thing at like farmers markets. And you're like, well, I guess I could buy a pint of ice cream for $13, but
yeah,
I could also not do that. And, you know, sorry, mom and pop ice cream shop. But, you know, Spurley comes in and, they have a pretty tedious conversation.
Oh, it's so tedious. It is just, this is just the musings of Sean Penn done in very clumsy dialogue with two people who have not existed or nor will ever exist in any kind of reality or have not really existed in fiction before either. There is no precedent, nor will there ever be. This cannot be explained. It is just his terrible, terrible musings. Again, I think it was in the same clip. I did see that, the Kimmel clip. He said that he laughed a lot while he wrote his own stuff.
Yes, and yes.
So as I was, and I was aware of that while reading this, and I'm just like, where is the laughs? How?
Yeah. So I did try to note the places that I thought might be jokes as we go through this, but they do not occur in this section. If you listen to that Sean Penn interview, you just sort of imagine that sort of rambling uncertainty as he was writing these next few passages, because they're all just sort of his own worldview sort of inserted into this book. But Bob did not listen as Spurley spoke, his own thoughts stirring. Spurley, have you ever heard the phrase "democracy dies in darkness"? Which to me, I put the book down and had to take some deep breaths into a paper bag. Then Spurley says, "No, Bob." And then Bob says, "I wonder, are we the darkness, Spurley?" That is there's many things here of the guy in the front row of Philosophy 101 sort of like trying to call out a professor here. And I think that was that was the first one I noted in this section.
Yeah, that is along the lines of the legend of a philosophy class where The final was just the question "Why" on a piece of paper.
Oh my god!
And the kid who wrote "Why not" and returned it, you know, got an A or whatever. Like, no, he did not. He did not. First of all, he didn't do it, and secondly, he did not get an A.
And that student, though, Mike, was Albert Einstein.
Can you tell me? Can anyone tell me what this means? Bob is doing his musings. It's not even worth reading them, but he finishes and he says, "I tell you this because I love you. Simply Georgia, 1658. Any idea what that is, what it means, what it references? And then Spurley says, you're confusing me, Bob, Spurley says.
And then, thank you. Thank you, Spurley.
But anyway, here's the joke.
But I have no idea what Georgia 1658 means.
Okay. Well,
there's no sign that was when, you know, Oglethorpe colonized it or anything like that. If you Google it, all you get is a creative branding studio that's based there that I don't think he's relating to, and then addresses. So,
okay. So you found the same thing when you looked it up.
Yes.
Which, of course, irritated me to have to do. But moving on from there, here's the joke that I think that this is what he laughed out loud when he wrote this. Spurley deflects the question. You interested in spies, Bob? Me? Bob asks, which is what you do when someone asks you a question. You say, right, yes. Me? That's right, Bob. Spies. I'm interested sometimes in eyes, mostly women's eyes. That's a bit like spies, I think. So I think that's where the joke is.
Sure. He saw like the Cockney rhyming slang humor and decided that was a little too laugh out loud funny and just decided to take it a bit more esoteric.
Yeah. So that's, you know, page after page of that, because this thing is not short. I mean, a lot of the previous chapters, little interludes and everything, no matter how horrible they are, they don't usually last long, at least. Mm-hmm. And this one lasted quite a while.
And then even in some of those other chapters, at least in theory, something happened. You know, he saw a chimera in a bikini guzzling tequila on a boat in the Gulf of Mexico. So,
yeah,
that was a thing that happened. It's not just a guy coming in and asking Bob questions that he responds to in confusion to.
Yeah. And half the time doesn't listen. And then there's a long con here. There's a long con. Remember that joke about the cherry, maraschino cherry?
Sure.
The payoff comes. Because Bob or Spurley asks him, hey, that cherry I left in the glass the last time I saw you, did you keep it? So,
Yes, it was a runner, I guess.
Bob, wow, when you got gold like that, yeah, you can't just, yeah. It's definitely got to be a runner.
the follow-up to that was, silly questions of cherries saved served to sever any last impressions Bob might have had of Spurley as a serious citizen. So I at that point in time, I was not sure if that was something he didn't remember, if there was like, if we were having some sort of tip off here. Like, a lot of people have written in about Bob as an unreliable narrator, which, you know, I told one guy, like, yeah, but in order for me to care about that, there would have to be something going on. Like, there's no reason to believe he is reliable, but like, he's not telling us about anything that we presumed might actually have happened. Like, so it's hard to get too worked up about whether it's reliable or not.
Right. If someone's telling you you're bored out of your skull and you couldn't care less, and they're telling you a story, your first thought isn't like, is this story true? Your first thought is, I got to get the hell out of here. And that's what this book is like.
I had one more thing from the conversation with Spurley. It was not all fun and games. There was a thing, a passage where Bob says in the third person, you know how and why Bob's going to die? With a blowtorch to my genitals and a foreign or non-foreign cock in my mouth. And this was hard for me to read because I've actually never told you before, but I had a twin brother who went the same way. Bob was describing.
I'm sorry to have to. Yeah, those wounds. You don't want to. Yeah.
So it was a free couch on Craigslist that got sort of turned on its head. the blowtorch to the genitals was a unexpected thing for Connor too.
Yeah.
The last thing in that segment was, this was something that I thought it was just so clear that Sean Penn was just looking for an excuse to put some weird musings or rants type of thing in here. But it was so sloppily done in this section. He's watching he's watching the news, I guess. And there's a report about how some police had been shot. But then, like, the day before, there were stories about police shooting people. And so he, in order to make this wedged into the book, Penn writes, "It occurs to Bob that the media had effectively encouraged the killing of cops with that previous day's reporting meant to buoy its own fraudulent Negrocentrism and grandiose liberal enlightenment." So he's doing a thing where he has this terrible theory, but he just puts, "It occurs to Bob that theory."
Yeah.
So that he's able to wedge it into the book.
Right.
So I took a stab at the at another author doing it something in that same way. "It occurred to Bob that the green light on the end of Daisy's dock represented not just Gatsby's unattainable love for Daisy, but truly the unattainable nature of the American dream, which was just that, a dream, a fantasy fed to sheep like so many sprouted grains of alfalfa."
Oh, very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a pretty crappy way to have a character come to a realization.
Yeah. Well, I also thought the conceit of the guy coming to interview him, and then he just turns and watches the TV for 15 minutes to be a little hard to swallow too. Like, you can't just in the middle of your scene with a guy, like, this is his, you know, this guy is haunting him. He keeps coming back to his house, and then they just stop and watch TV together for that pissed me off as well.
Right. It's like, it's sort of a Kleinian touch. Just, you know, we're reading about a kid who's watching Family Ties.
Yeah. Well, frankly, it's all a bunch of swine sugar. You know what I mean?
I do. I do. It's very Georgia 1658.
That was another one that I resentfully looked up. I have nothing came up for that.
Hogwash? I mean, is that a no? But like, whatever.
Well, it didn't appear. I mean, it seems like maybe it's something that could exist, but it also could completely be made up by Sean Penn. So, again, all it did was serve to irritate me.
But the main takeaway is that Bob's irrational passion for dispassionate rationality is for him irreconcilable, which is a pet peeve of mine. When my irrational passion for dispassionate rationality becomes irreconcilable, and just, you know,
yeah,
I just,
of course,
grit my teeth and like, God, I hate it when this happens.
That may have been one of the sentences that I sent my wife, who's in the other room working. and it was like a little time bomb because, you know, I knew that she doesn't sit there and obsessively check her emails. And so like 20 minutes later, I heard, "Oh, God, you got to be kidding me," like through a closed door.
Yeah.
So I haven't done that much to her because she's growing weary of it. But yeah. Then she heard me later. She heard maybe some light profanity, and then she came out later and she's like, "Sean Penn got you down again."
Yeah.
He sure does.
Yeah, it is. It's like lobbing a stink bomb into a room where you're like, you know, count down from 10 before it's going to hit anyone's nose. He talked about what was the guy's name that you, Eustace Conway.
Yeah.
That's in this section. He doesn't want to become a Eustace Conway.
Yep. Which I had never heard of.
I assumed it was maybe like a guy that had a show about him in the 60s or something, like a Mountain Grizzly Adams type of guy. But he was a guy that just, you know, This American Life was reporting about at the turn of the millennium, I guess. He biked across the country and then has a sort of he seems sort of like a guy that had sort of declared eminent domain on some land or something. But a minor case, not a guy that really made gigantic headlines, at least nationally.
No, not someone you just whip out in your book and expect to have everyone go, "Oh, I know. Oh boy, he's made a good point here."
Yes. It's like, you know, yeah, I don't want to end up like, you know, Patrick Chu. That's a guy that I went to third through sixth grade with, and he didn't go to middle school with the rest of us. He went to a different middle school, so we sort of lost touch. So I don't want that to have that. I don't want that to happen.
Yeah, it's the there was a kid who we went to school with, and his dad's name was Hector. And his last name, I won't say just for no reason, but we would say, what in the Hector? And then we'd say that guy's last name because everybody knew him and he was a colorful character. And so I'd said that once out of context to somebody else. Wow. I went like, what in the Hector? And they went, what the hell did you just say?
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, we got saying it in high school. I'll drop it now. And then I haven't said it again. But that's Sean Penn's entire book is that. So
sure. It's also characters wondering if any notion of interculturalism might be foiled by the science of the brain, which is something that, again, I wonder a lot, too.
Yeah, I'm constantly,
you know.
Is love only visible in the art of angels and tomorrow's children? Is a thing that I muse upon as well.
That was a firm settle down in the, because that was capping off a whole list of questions that was, you know, are we truly able to understand each other or do not to? Is culturalism explained by brain science or foiled by it? And then, yes, is love only visible in the art of angels and tomorrow's children?
Yeah, boy. I wish you had the stamp there for the boom, 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 boom. Yeah.
There's a section later that I want to do sort of a line by read of, so it's not worth doing here. But those three questions, I'm not sure what he's supposed to be getting at. I mean, I guess plot wise, he's worried that, you know, Spurley is going to expose his elderly killing scheme, which I have to imagine is true. That has to be why he's there. But I don't know what the Art of Angels and Tomorrow's Children has to do with any of these situations.
Well, no matter. Phil Ock wraps it all up for us once again.
My God. I was like, Phil Ock thinks there's too much Phil Ock in the book. Yeah.
This is his deus ex machina, I guess. He gets himself, writes himself into a corner and, come on, bail me out, Phil Ock.
Right. It was maybe a bar bet or something where he was, you know, he was down in Belize with Phil Ox, and, you know, they, after the fifth Top Shelf Marg, they were like, he's like, I'm going to put you in my book four times. And he's like, no, it's like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to put you in.
I'm totally going to. You'll see. Yeah. We're going to write it. Yep. Well, then we get to luckily the lightheartedness comes back again with Station 11, Mein Drumpf.
Yeah. This is one that we've been waiting for ever since we saw it pop up in the table of contents.
And as I read it, I couldn't help but think, I bet if Drumpf were to read this himself, he'd probably go, what in the name of hell is he talking? I'm sure there's an insult in here somewhere, but I can't noodle it out.
Yeah, it was sort of disappointing to once actually reading it, it didn't deliver on the hashtag level comedy of the title.
Yeah, I was hoping he would really wind himself up for this, but he just sort of fizzles.
it starts with Bob sitting on the couch watching TV. So riveting novel from the very beginning. But it says that there's another debate over guns. This is another sort of self-insert of a worldview of Sean Penn. Bob sometimes doesn't know what the fuss is all about. It seems to him that words are as lethal as any weapon. Words, unburdened by background checks and available at all times to all persons. And so that was another guy in the front row of the philosophy class to me. What if words are more dangerous than guns?
Right.
Type of question.
Yeah, it's sticks and stones may break your bones kind of a thing there. He whips that out as a deep thought.
That would be a good thing for Annie to have said to Bob Bean in one of her little psychic messages he's sending him. Sticks and stones can break your bones, my gruff goat.
This is exactly where I thought, man, he dodged a bullet with this Annie character. It's a good thing she's out of this. This does not seem like someone you want to log a lot of time with. Here's one of their dialogues. And again, I understand he's an unreliable narrator, but I can only take what he gives me. Do you think it's possible to sell your soul to Satan? To a darkness, Bob Beam? A darkness, Annie? Yeah, like Led Zeppelin. Didn't they, my gruff goat? Yeah, yeah, you got to ditch this chick right now. Right,
yes, exactly.
This is not good.
It was tough to read that, though, because my mom's nickname for my twin brother who died with a blowtorch to his genitals was her gruff goat. So it's really hitting home this last section.
Yeah, boy. Ooh, fresh pain.
There, But there was another part that reminded me for the second time. I mean, now I'm going to do it for everything, but I'm going to tie every book I read into Elton John's Levon. We had him, the wildly successful ice cream business in the last episode, but this was part of it, like reminded me of another part of the song. Together they make a mockery of mockery, mimicking mystery. That's alone we could probably talk about for an hour. But this surmises, Bob, is the only reasonable explanation for the bloated blonde high priest and Pavonine of branding. Pavonine means like a peacock. I had to look it up.
Same
the
here.
Master, yep. The masturbatory populist who's become a media sensation and then some during his candidacy for king, making despots sing and helping the retro party so inviting of the stupid to conscript the even stupider. Bob likes Jupiter. And Levon wants to go to Venus or Jesus and leave Levon far behind. So based on the fact that it rhymes with stupider, Bob desires to go to Jupiter to avoid human contact, I suppose. Maybe he just wants to get away from Levon's cartoon balloon business.
Yeah, that's where I pulled that line, the planet of polar cyclones, to as a possible title for a coronet short.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Ah. But yeah, Annie takes it at face value. Jupiter, gruff. So that's now we've shortened.
Name
yeah.
Name.
The planet of polar cyclones. Is that what you say when someone tells you they want to go to Jupiter? That planet, yeah. That one.
What is the defining characteristic of Jupiter? It's something that, you know, in third grade, you learn about it.
It's certainly polar, polar cyclones. Yes.
The enormous red spot, which maybe it is. Maybe that is a polar cyclone. Maybe that's, but that requires some deep research into the planet.
So there's a bunch of musing, and then a real action set piece happens. Bob decides to throw a party for his neighbors.
Yes. Please.
So he makes
something happen here.
He makes collage invitations, and he walks mailbox to mailbox, and then he prepares the food. And I wondered if you paused over this. Bob sets up the briquette grill for burgers and dogs, makes 100 juice lemon style deviled eggs. Is that a thing?
I wrote exactly that, a thing. And then I wrote, they are not. One, juice lemons, I don't know what's going on. I don't know if there's differences between types of lemons. I don't know what you use lemons for. If not, they're juice. So it's hard for me to wrap my head around that. But juice lemon style deviled eggs.
Yeah, and he's hyphenating it as though, yeah, he's coining a word here, or yeah, juice lemon style.
Maybe it was a collaboration between like CNN anchor Don Lemon and OJ Simpson, the Juice, who like teamed up, like they had their own like deviled egg cook-off recipe. So I can't even finish that sentence. It's so stupid.
He says, a little musing here, like the heart, brain, liver, or kidney, skin, too, is a vital organ. And that confused me. Skin? You mean derma.
Ah, sure. Derma. There we go. Yeah. I thought about Norman Bates calling a grilled cheese a toasted cheese sandwich when I read that. That was his sandwich of choice in Psycho 2.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, the sandwich comes back later.
Yes, it does indeed.
Yeah.
Isn't there something, don't we have another like running joke about someone calling referring to a food item by something completely ludicrous?
I think that hamburger sandwich is along. That was in a short or something like, hey, let's go grab a hamburger sandwich.
Yes. That has always bothered me. A hamburger steak as well.
Yeah. But I don't have a lot of notes about this. I just have a general question. What in the name of hell is going on with the Sid and Nancy couple?
Yeah.
I mean, I have so many questions, and yet I don't even want to, I don't know where to start or end. So if you have any thoughts on it, please.
Sure. Yeah, we'll describe it for people who aren't reading along, which seems to, a lot more people seem to be doing that this time around. Bob has organized a neighborhood barbecue. He sent these people, I guess, you know, what are meant to resemble ransom note collages, invitations. And the first people to arrive are prompt to the minute. It is a young man and woman of seemingly late adolescence, though pushing an infant in a stroller before them. Think Sid and Nancy. Think bruised veins. Think toxic pale skin. Think body odor marching four from meters away. And I was just like, for the love of God, can we please just get a normal, like, 6 out of 10 attractive person in this book? Everyone is just this revolting display of just, like, body odor and you know, smeared lipstick and sharding and stuff.
Yeah, it is. He has a very grim outlook of other human beings. And I don't know, is it self-loathing or something? Is he not happy with, but the human body is not for him, clearly.
So the people start like interrupting each other to try to finish a sentence. They're obviously meant to be strung out. They play rock, paper, scissors to decide who will talk. The woman's nose starts bleeding profusely. And then Bob gets up every now and then twice to check the infant's pulse, which is meant, I think, to maybe be a joke. Like Bob is just checking to see if these people are capable of caring for an infant.
Yeah, that's the kind of clowning we've come to expect from Bob, right? This flat, dead sack of crap who walks around murdering people. Right. Suddenly he's doing this, you know, Marx Brothers bit with the baby.
Yeah.
I did not understand that.
Yeah, it's like his got your nose type of thing. But then it turns out that he was sort of right to be suspicious because they ask him if he would mind watching their children. They remark that they have twins, and Bob is like, there's only one child in your stroller. And they're like, oh man, I must have lost the baby somewhere. So they ask him if he will babysit for them. And Bob's response is, this is a community building exercise, says Bob, a block party. I am not a child nurturing individual. And after several beats of mutually confused silence and the girl's nasal hemorrhage now streaming, the couple depart without comment.
Yeah, so her nose is pouring blood.
They've lost a baby. The other baby has been mistaken for dead multiple times. And yet I think we're supposed to think it's funny.
Yeah, like, yeah, I think this is the part he was laughing when he wrote it. but I think that the way you described it makes a little more sense than what is actually here, I think. I don't think they say, can you watch my kid while we go look for the other? Because this is what they said. Like, that's a kind of weird and sort of fucked up, but like, if we kind of find the other one, are you cool babysitting? So I don't know what does that mean? If we find the other one, are you cool babysitting?
Yeah, maybe they just, since they know each other and they're friends, they're going to hit him up for favors.
Yeah. So anyway, that whole interaction, I guess I can only guess it's his sense of humor, but it is puzzling.
Sure. But the whole that whole lighthearted anecdote is only a setup to the reason that nobody has come to eat his juiced lemon style deviled eggs is because he planned his event for the same day as his nosy neighbor Helen Mayo's funeral, because it evidently has taken months to certify her death, since her scorched body parts were so interchangeably intertwined and inkle-mingled with the manglement of the pilot seat's turbine's tenant. Bob had inadvertently invited a neighborhood of strangers on the day their pre-commitment to Helen Mayo's funeral procession prevailed.
And for this funeral, they went all out because they rented 40 limousines for it. So it wasn't the procession of their own cars. It says explicitly 40 black limos. So
yeah,
she was quite beloved. Helen Mayo was.
Yeah, we were given, you know, she was presented as sort of a annoying and shrill and possibly paranoid person in her thing. But yeah, evidently it was the sort of beloved neighborhood fixture that requires the full thing. The ice cream truck is part of the procession, and everyone sort of like drives by and glares at him. So it's again, it could be a scene that could be played for laughs if a defter hand was directing it. You know, the I wonder where everyone could be 3-minute scene of 40 limos proceeding past and everyone glaring at Bob, like, and then him being like, oh, that's where they are. But I just am puzzled about how it took possibly so long for her to be proclaimed dead.
Because she was tangled up, with the pilot. but Bob eats a deviled egg and sits till sunset. One of those, periods of time. Yeah, I don't know what a deviled egg is. Does he mean a lemon juice style? Or? play us out, Phil Ox. Huh?
Yep.
He's in trouble again, so rescue us, Phil, which he does. Reading the Phil Ox lyrics? I find myself kind of skipping those.
I read I'm kind of skipping them, but I listened to the love me lovely. I'm a liberal song. And that was, I didn't need to hear any more.
Okay.
If I've made it this far in my life without anyone being like, you should really know, check it out. Check out Phil Ox. This never happened, so it's not going to happen now.
Your Spotify suggestions are going to be a little skewed now that you listen to that.
Spotify needs an incognito mode, just as a complete aside. It needs to be able to not. I think they do know when you've only listened to something once, you know, if you've listened to Baby Shark just to check it out because you're hearing people talk about it. But right. I think that they know that that's not an ongoing thing.
Well, you know, we had a funeral. We had all of that darkness. We had the bleeding people. We had the possibly dead child. Let's lighten things up by going to Hurricane Katrina and bloated corpses, shall we?
Yes. Oh man. Yeah. So we talked about it before, but he's like the Forrest Gump of politicized national tragedy.
Yes.
Like there's nothing too devastating for him to attach weight to his own garbage story by popping up in it.
Yeah, he's doing the, you know, like invoking 9/11 for your terrible Marvel movie kind of moment.
Right.
Like,
yes.
How dare you? Jeez.
Right. Yeah, there's like, you know, I remember Transformers had like shots of two like twin buildings like collapsing to the ground as, you know, Bumblebee is punching, you know, a guy who was trying to leer at Megan Fox. And it's like, not earned, yeah. Not earned.
Boy, this is this was a tough chapter, this one.
Yeah. So yeah, Bob has, it's 2005 and Bob is, has wound up in New Orleans, I think on some sort of mission for the Scottsdale project, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. But he goes with the volunteers to do it. So he's
yeah. Well, so first of all, he's the hurricane is struck. He's trying to get out of town, but he's unable to. So he goes to a shelter in some sort of gym or, you know, I don't think it was the Superdome. But he meets a young woman there who's been sort of like drinking to take her mind off the tragedy. And so this young woman, just pretend you haven't read it. Do you think she's going to be sprightly, you know, perky, happy, like, you know, her smile brightens up a room.
Yeah, I would say upbeat and, you know, attractive in a sort of a plain way, but very
girl next door kind of thing.
Yeah. And an appeal that was immediate because of her sunny disposition.
Right. Turns out she's a drunk young female volunteer with lipstick smeared on her teeth. Which is, if you're not mistaken, this is the second young woman who has had that particular feature. So we speculated before, but was this something that was happening to Madonna? Was Robin Wright just like constantly, you know, asking him to check to see if she had got lipstick on her teeth and it really bugged him? Like, what on earth?
Well, I mean, the other one was a chimera. You'd expect that. But this is just a woman. So yes. I don't get the trait. But here's a typical thing that people say when they offer stuff to me. They say, put this in your mouth. Smell it. That's what people do when they offer you a drink of their, you know, a pull off their cantina.
Sure. Yeah, that very much puzzled me as well. And Bob did not take her up on that offer, believe it or not, which is maybe the first relatable thing he's done.
What do you is that again? Is that pen humor? What's happening? Put this in your mouth, smell it. I mean, are we using words as things to convey things, or are we just
that ship has sailed?
Okay, all right. Okay, well, moving on.
Maybe it's something that they're. Maybe it's his version of what the Hector. Maybe it's just something he forgot to explain to us.
Yeah.
But yes, he gets wind that there's a group of volunteers going out in a boat to investigate a nursing home to, you know, in theory, rescue these people. And Bob spies an opportunity to bonk him on the head with his mallet. So he goes with the intent of doing that. They go into a New Orleans nursing home. They don't find anybody, but while everyone else is checking out the upper floors, Bob just guns the motor of the boat and takes off.
Mm-hmm. He takes off past the sailors set sail past bloated floaters, ballooned by the bacteria of gut-released gases under too much sun, all face down and spread eagle body blimps in the calm black water. Thanks, Sean.
Yes.
I'll read that and I'll keep reading and be happy to do it.
Right. He was laughing a lot when he wrote the book. I wonder, I mean, it's too bad on the talk shows he didn't, you know, follow up his heated pool joke with reading an actual excerpt from it, like the way they do show clips, because it would have been really fun to see like what he would have picked and how, you know, Conan or Jimmy would have responded to a passage about bloated corpses.
Or this would have been good for the live reading. The subsiding floodwaters were beginning to expose cells of sanctimony and their cancerous divisive detriment deluged by adenosine triphosphate 42 delivering de-evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Applause.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'll leave off there. I know you want more, but I gotta sell some copies of this book. So you're gonna have to read more. Yeah, the sentence right before that one was, and with that, Bob suddenly saw himself among those full of rage against their own insignificance and subject to the seductions of vainglorious gestalt.
Whew.
Bob suddenly saw that happen. So like that was just a. That was like a light bulb going off that people were subject to the seductions of vainglorious gestalt. But then the sentence after the one you read, it should be noted that New Orleans famous goat of Algiers did survive the flood.
Yes, I noted that as well. Oh boy, Bob, he says after that. Mm-hmm.
So the goat of Algiers, what did you find?
I didn't look it up.
So again, just like Georgia 1658, I don't know that what he's talking about. I don't know that this is a thing.
Oh, really? No returns on that?
No, you get a return, but it's the text of Bob Honey who just do stuff.
Oh, my God.
If you don't put goat of Algiers in quotes, you get a story about how like 2 or 3 years ago there was some like, abandoned lot that a woman was letting her goats graze on. And some guy came by and cut off one of the goat's heads. And it happened in like the Algiers township or something. I don't think that's what he's talking about. I do not think that that's what this is related to, because that was a young goat, so it wouldn't have been around in Katrina. Puzzling, to say the least.
Oh, just so unnecessary, too. Just, yeah. Again, stop it. Let's do some fun interlude. What do you got? Do you want to do?
Sure. Yes. Let's do some fanfic because wow. Yep. These are some fun ones this time.
All right. Fucking now I bet they bitching because my flow switching, trying to tell me what to write. I bought some fan fiction. Can't they just be happy? I no longer have to face eviction that I'm living on my life. I'm living on my inner vision right now. Take us away, fan fiction. Take us away.
Let's do it. So we're going to read 5 segments, and they are either actual things from the final quarter of Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff, or they are fan fiction excerpts written by our listeners. And this one's proven challenging, I think, for everybody. It's proven hard to write in this style. It's proven hard to fool you, but it's also proven hard for you to guess. So it's sort of been a blind dartboard situation.
This is. Although I think, was it last time I had some success?
You aced. So it was just, you know, unexpected. I'm not sure how that happened, but we'll see how this week goes. So again, 5 excerpts.
All right.
First one, number one. Can you turn the TV up? I've been waiting to hear what my man from Duck Dynasty got to say. Where's Annie? Bob blurts through the door. Who's Annie? She Russian? Ain't seen no Annie on the traffic. He goes on. Let me wipe my butt. We'll hear out the Duck Dynasty boy. Then I'll get you some girls and druggies. Bob finds himself at the end of his rope. He kicks in the door of the bathroom. Lewd star sitting on the toilet. Grass skirt around his ankles.
Well, I have to come clean. I accidentally read ahead.
No!
Yeah, but not too far. But I did... Okay. Get to that, and that unfortunately is quite real.
Okay.
sorry about that, everyone. I'm sorry.
So you couldn't stop, it was a page turner.
I think I didn't I wasn't able to remember our own assignment, and so I just kept reading because I just was like, look, I'm doing it.
Wow.
So I didn't finish or anything, but I read ahead and then I realized I overread. So
this is a bad decision. All right. Well, that's one correct. The second one, settling into the couch's dull embrace, he surveils through the strategic slice parting the picture window curtains. On Sweet Dog Lane, a pair of pubescently paralyzed pixies in spaghetti straps and one oaf in practical full dress for animal containment, Garrison Greens lumbers up the Mayo household tarmac. Bob hunkers in serenely expectant stasis, unexposed Viet Cong. The unlikely heroes transmit a disturbance to the Pella-branded door, a demand for canine surrender, and a fear of the greater good.
I think that's fan fiction, but it's very good. I'm just guessing. I'm 100% guessing.
It is fan fiction.
Nice.
But yeah, it's a it didn't try to do too much, you know. It wasn't trying to be funny. It was just like it easily could be a slice of the book.
Yeah, definitely.
especially with the unexposed Viet Cong, which harkens back to too much Vietnam. A little more Vietnam. All right, number three. Where did all the laughs go? Are you out there, Louis C.K.? Once crucial conversations kept us on our toes, was it really in our interest to trample Charlie Rose? And what's with this Me Too, this infantilizing term of the day? Is this a toddler's crusade, reducing rape, slut-shaming, and suffrage to reckless child's play? A platform for accusation impunity? Due process has lost its sheen. But fuck it. What, me worry?
Wow. Oh, it's very tough as well. I don't know. I'm gonna say that's real.
So yeah, keep in mind, I posted my terrible poem that I had written recently to our Patreon and encouraged people to write their own bad poems.
Oh, nice, nice.
But you're going with real?
Yeah, I'm gonna say real.
It is real.
Wow.
That is an excerpt. The epilogue of the book contains a long poem.
Oh, goody.
That includes lines like, where did all the laughs go? Are you out there, Louis C.K.?
Wow.
So, you know, I guess maybe this was just something. This could have been the real reason he wrote the book, was just to have a place to publish this awful poem.
Well, we all know where all the laughs are. They're in this book, clearly.
Yeah, they were in his room as he was writing it.
Yeah.
All right, so 3 for 3 so far. Here's number four. The giggle becomes a laugh. Soon she guffaws herself from stool to floor. She begins to writhe, cackle, and cough out her laughter uncontrollably. Her eyes watering, she nearly poos. Bob spies what might be a dime size and expanding moisture blossom from her rear end center, signifying perhaps some minimal ass piss. Bob looks at her rolling and cackling on the floor. She can only hand gesture to remind him not to look at her.
I think this might have been used in a previous one. This is real.
Oh, yes, very real.
Yeah. I think it came up. It might have come up before.
Oh, man. I someone emailed that last week. I did not remember the phrase minimal ass piss. So, man, that is real. I don't know who this character is. I imagine she does have lipstick smeared on her teeth, however. And that's our Oscar winner's depiction of an encounter here.
So you people who aren't reading along, this is what you're missing out on. Come on, people. This is coming up.
I will note that ass piss, just like juice lemon style, is hyphenated. So,
So let's get, you know, eventually when the usage becomes common enough, they take away the hyphen and it becomes one word. So,
yes.
So look forward to that.
All right. Last one. No once and future jarhead. Bob refuses the ubiquitous electric razor. Shaking his head to his own tune of the world ending, the man scruff shuffles around the chrome throne's foot appendage. Shining scissors and unhealthily dull surfaced comb turn past Bob's eye level. In the undulated robe light reflection, the bumpkin barber passes the comb over Bob's burned brow. Micro corkscrew blackened frizzin drizzles before Bob's right eye. Gas can accident? The deep crevices of the barber make an inquiry. I got clotheslined, shall we say, Bob admits.
Well, I just, by process of elimination, I'm sure that's fan fiction, but again, it's very good.
It is. And it's like, you know, compared to the last one, it just maybe didn't go stupid enough.
Right.
But yes, another 5 for 5. There was both those fan fictions were by M. Williams, and the other three were all real and about as absurd as any real passages we've ever read.
Yeah, I liked his edition of, what was it, the barber from his crevices or something.
Deep
like
crevices,
that?
Crevices, yeah.
They
extreme lots in there.
Yeah, nobody's a normal human anywhere in this book.
Yeah, well, that was real fanfic. Well done to everybody who sent those in all of the segments. It's very fun, and you know, it is fun to see what you're able to do in terms of picking out the what signifies the real and fake ones for you.
Yeah, thank you for doing that, because we know in order to do them, you have to have read the book. So these people are stepping up. Come on, the rest of you.
Yes. So we then resume, not with a station, but with a interlude, which if you're not reading along, it involves Helen Mayo's daughter, Helen Mayo Jr., calling into 911 because she's up on a power line.
Lift.
Yeah, power line cherry picker or whatever. And she's observing Bob in his yard, and she's very concerned about this. I have one. Oh, no, I have two. I have two isolated passages.
Oh, I think I know where you're going to go. What do you got for us?
He's out there in that yard of his, pruning a melaleuca tree in all the wind with his belly out and sweating in his skivvies. Again, just a delightful picture. I think he's somehow sending signals. I know he's a white man, but somehow, sometimes he just looks very Chinese to me. Those awful eyes of his swell with bad deeds. And I don't believe this chink is just bonsai gardening, if you know what I mean. Ma'am, bonsai gardeners are Japanese, not Chinese.
So we've got... I wrote, that's her problem with that sentence.
So yeah, the 911 operator is up on that, first of all, but she's fielding the casual racism from her Helen Mayo Jr.'s distraught daughter.
And the Mayo family gets another indignity visited upon it as she falls from the scissor lift and dies. So
yes, there is a there was a great stage direction right before that happens. It was just bracket all caps unintelligible screaming before it was revealed that she had fallen off the lift to her death. I thought she might have just picked up a copy of Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff. Cause the unintelligible screaming.
Well, the very lucid screaming that normally happens when someone falls off a scissor lift.
So yeah, that's just a brief little palate cleanser in between the chapters.
Right, right. Interludes, you know, they're you know, you often you think of like a light piano work or something to just sort of you know, pass a little time in pleasantness, and that's what that interlude was, as a screaming woman died on a scissor lift.
And again, possibly played for laughs. I mean, she was racist, so she's a bad person, I guess, so maybe we're meant to take delight in that. But it doesn't seem like Bob noticed or even cared.
He should have given her some ass piss to really really make it, bring it home.
So that, you know, ended on a bit of a downer, but we're gonna have some more laughs coming, because Station 13 is titled Opiates and Incest.
And this one starts with this jargon at the beginning is infuriating. And I just wrote, is this intended to shake off the very few readers who are still hanging in this far?
Yeah, he has 6 footnotes in the first 3 pages of the chapter, and they're mostly military jargon. Like, do you have any examples? I didn't write them down.
INCONUS, ZTC, AO, USG, and on and on.
So there you go. It doesn't really add anything to the thing. It certainly, I'm glad I didn't have to Google like I did the Goat of Algiers or Eustace Conway or Georgia 1658, but it adds nothing to my understanding of or appreciation of what's happening, just to have this stuff thrown in.
No, this does seem like a brag of his. Like, I've hung around military people. I picked this stuff up, and now you're going to have to hear it. Because, yeah, it does. I mean, it's infuriating to have to read it and go, okay, all right, I'm going to look at what this is. And then it's like, why didn't you just say that? Just say that.
Right. It's like a computer programmer. It's like, if footnote... check footnote, like, if meaning not clearer, like, roll your eyes and move on to next sentence, like, which is just repeat.
Yeah.
But wasn't Gareth from The Office, didn't he do, like, whatever the equivalent is of the lamest branch of the British military service, and he was always, you know, trying to drop jargon into their things, and no one took it seriously.
Right. Yeah, there are a lot of dumb sentences came out of this, but here's one that I just thought, no one reads this, and then... continues reading. Has Spurley been a phalanx proxy of dual 4-barrel reconnaissance?
Yeah, I was wondering that myself.
Yeah, no, that's not a sentence you read and go, I'm gonna continue. I have to find out if he is. I can't wait to discover that.
There's more talk about him going sitting on the can and doing some deep thinking. He wandered into the bathroom, did some thinking, but then he wandered back to the bedroom, sat on the edge of his bed, and then watches some more TV. So another more in common with Klein than we would have thought. But on TV, the blonde buffoon who aligns himself with Law and Order like a cartoon, and it gets Bob thinking. Bob is about to have another realization. Could this high priest of branding himself be conspiring against the beheading of the unbranded? Could he be?
I can't wait to find out.
Bob is thinking that, though. That's a thought that is unique to the character of Bob in this book.
Oh, Bob Honey's deep thoughts.
So not all the footnotes were military jargon. We got one because he mentions the Knight of the Long Knives.
Yeah, that one I knew, so I didn't have to waste time looking that up.
Okay, but did you know what the candidate's own Knight of the Long Knives might be on a putsch means?
I don't know what a putsch.
Okay.
But I know the word putsch.
Oh, what does it mean?
Well, it's like a military coup or something, right? Something by, okay, by force, I believe.
Okay. But then he keeps going. Has he famously had residence and golf courses in the greater Miami area? All roads lead to Lewdstar. Bob weighs his options. He can drive the Pontiac from Woodview to South Beach in 4 days, five if he stops in New Orleans. And I don't know where you've read further than me, but it sounds like Bob is contemplating driving to Miami to try to kill Donald Trump.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. So this book is about to bite off quite a bit.
I have a question backing up. I know I'm supposed to remember this. Who is Lewdstar?
Lewdstar is the New Guinean grass-skirted potential cannibal that ran a paramilitary unit in, saying this out loud sounds so stupid, in post invasion Iraq. Okay. Remember they had those guys Muslim, they were freaked out by these guys who were wearing grass skirts. And I was just glad to see a great character like this coming back.
Well, what I thought when we got to this part, because he's going to, he can drive the Pontiac and blah, 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 if he stops in New Orleans, I just thought, road trip, like, this is going to be a blast.
Yeah. Cue Radar Love, the open cooler in the back seat.
Yeah. Yeah. And Bob's take on, kitschy America is going to be a lot of fun, you know.
Right. He's posing next to the world's largest fiberglass muskie.
Right.
He's going to that place from Pee-wee's Big Adventure with all the dinosaurs.
But he does, what does he do? He puts like the C4 around his house or whatever. And
yes, yes. He, well,
which
not
was
C4.
Referenced in the earlier thing. Yeah.
Yeah. He secures the penetralia of his Woodview province with a room to room and around the house intertwine of mother-in-law's clothesline. And we get a footnote. Mother-in-law's clothesline, a colloquialism for a long word and another long word, detonation cord, which explodes at a rate of 64,000 m per second and resembles common clothesline. So this is, we laughed at him in the last book because the evil guy blew up the 64 squares tower with 64 stories of explosive rope. But I guess the joke was on us because that's evidently a real thing that Bob Honey is securing his house with.
Well, I knew that there was detonation cord, but
sure. Yeah. But if all the things that we're going to have a parallel between these two books, this would have been possibly the thing I would have least expected.
That is true. That is true. And so he sets off on the road trip. And so he's in the white Pontiac. And here's a sentence that really jumped out at me. These are just one observer's thoughts from within a white Pontiac drifting through the American nightscape. Because he kind of muses on everything. And it seems to me like this is the equivalent of someone telling you something that's clearly not landing and then saying, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's just me. You know, like, right. Yeah, we know these are your musings, but it sounds right. Like he lost confidence in his own stupid observations and went,
right.
I don't know, this is just one guy's view of it. Maybe I'm wrong, you know?
Yeah, he's a sports talk radio caller who is called to demand that the backup quarterback be put in for Tom Brady, and then he realized that the host wasn't buying it. So he's like, you know what, I'll hang up and take your response off the air.
Right. we get back to, we said we would return to the sandwich.
Mm-hmm. The BLT or the grilled cheese.
Yeah. His incisors make surgical entry, initiating a delicately inconspicuous cut through the toasted buttery carapace. to which I just have in all caps, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up.
Yeah, the description of him eating had, I thought it was one of the worst similes in history. It says, without lowering his sandwich, his swallow slowly and quietly allows that first bite to drop like a special forces paratrooper into his belly.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Which is like, that's like, that's the, contest level of like trying to write a bad passage or a bad description.
Yeah. And clearly he's a fan of, Sean Penn is a fan of these sandwiches because the friggin' magic, frickin' diner grilled cheese magic.
Right.
But yeah, then he's interrupted by, without looking ahead, what sound does coffee make as it pours into a cup? If you could describe it in kind of, that sort of Mad Magazine style or cartoon, comic book, Batman kind of sound.
I mean, splash, I guess, is probably the way to, that's what hitting. I mean, it's sort of a, maybe that too.
Splash? Yeah. Splash? No.
Yeah.
Coffee goes blop, blop, blop. Clearly.
I imagine that exactly as a Batman, Biff Pow type of thing. But I don't know if the coffee was like having trouble, like it's like it was coming out of a super soaker or something. Like, how on earth was it like not a consistent stream of coffee being poured out of this thing?
And also, why all caps, exclamation point, blop, yes, blop, blop? I've never been interrupted by the sound of pouring coffee, so I guess I haven't had my musings so shockingly interrupted.
Sure. And the coffee was being poured by a skinny vanilla perfumed waitress, and I was stunned. Like, there's nothing. I mean, he says skinny, but like that's not necessarily a bad thing. But there's no lipstick on her teeth. She's not like, ass pissing. Like there's no.
Yeah, I wanted long descriptions of her sagging sallow flesh hanging like lizard skin around her nearly shattered bones of. Yeah.
She's like, I tried a slightly different mascara today. Like, I don't look that bad. Come on.
But who's our fella? Why?
Yep.
This is a magical moment as we meet our author, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. He's sitting next to at the counter, Sam Elliott style, Pappy Pariah of Kurtzstetter, Kentucky.
Pastor to the Argot Applied Appalachian Archdiocese. Mm-hmm. Ugh. To which, here I said I'd rewrite this for him. Here's how it should have read. I'm Pappy Pariah of Kurtzstetter, Kentucky, pastor to the Argot Applied Appalachian Archdiocese. Goodbye. But wait, I said goodbye.
Yes, exactly. I will pay for your lunch for you to stop talking to me.
Yeah. But no, we get the whole story here.
Yeah, and the, in case you were hung up on the skinny waitress, Pappy delivers on the criticism. That undernourished nymphomaniac over there just poured my coffee hot and black. Yeah. And I imagine she's just like over there, like, what the hell? Like, I wrote a smiley face on your check. That does not mean that I have, does not reveal my hidden nymphomaniac side.
Right. But then Pappy gives us a sort of, I don't know, beat poetry kind of thing. And is it sort of sunny and coherent? Or is it a word salad of garbage?
Right.
It's the latter.
This is what I wanted to take some time to sort of look at closely, just because, obviously, since based on fan fiction, we've got some terrible poetry coming. But this one is like it's the centerpiece of this chapter, really. And it's Pappy is a key figure in the Bob Honey mythos. So we should pay attention to what he's saying. So let's look at what his poem has to say. It takes very little time to drink a cup of wine or to destroy a village. So I guess that's like condemning these people who call in a drone strike while they're thousands of miles away drinking their wine. Is that sort of, that's the gist here?
I guess.
Sure.
It's not well done, but I guess. No.
And then the next part is one day soon, it will take a week to conquer the world and a couple of days to establish a motive. So that's sort of like a shoot first, ask questions later type of thing.
Right. Justify your wars after the fact, kind of a. Yeah.
So, you know, we're able to parse some meaning out here. It's not good and it's not, you know, enjoyable, but at least you get what he's saying. It currently takes about 1 hour to underestimate the compassion of a stranger.
I got nothing for you there. I got nothing.
I don't know who's underestimating the compassion of a stranger. I don't know what the hour time frame is, the precise time frame there. It's gone off the rails, Pappy. He says their face reflected on a burnish of black coffee in a quaint cafe. Unless we heard the sound that black coffee made in the quaint cafe, I don't know what to make of it. And then he brings it home. Again, no man learns to cycle rounds on a paper route, especially when he has egg on his face.
Yeah. And then we get the stylistic chapter end thing, like two lines, you know, like new section. And it just continues. Finally lowering his sandwich, Bob instinctively wipes his mouth with a napkin, inventories the napkin. No egg. But how could there be when eating a grilled cheese sandwich? So once again, Bob completely misunderstanding for no reason, so much so that he thought he might have egg on his face when he had not eaten an egg.
Okay. This ties into the dark web script that was unearthed.
Right, exactly.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm confused too, though, Bob. Like, I thought that it was this chapter demonstrated that Sean Penn had no idea which passage of his book required clarifying footnotes, because I don't know who's doing a paper route, why he would have egg on his face, how that relates to the terrible parts or the earlier poem, and what is going on.
Well, this is the kind of stuff that makes me doubt in the previous section when he's checking the pulse of an infant in a stroller, that's supposed to be a joke, because Bob clearly has no concept of how humanity works or how the world works. So, you know, if he like this, he's not doing a gag here with the egg, right? Because
I think he just heard the term he probably tuned Pappy's poem out, and then just sort of like, you know, the clues of the context, clues of the conversation, made him snap back once he realized the poem was over, and then all he heard was egg on his face. So like, he might have just like thought that would happen. I mean, you know, maybe I'm sympathetic to him in this scenario.
That's true. But then Bob, so is this Bob being funny again when he asks him, what's with all the opiates and incest in your area?
So I will admit that I stopped reading after the poem, because I'm pretty sure that was what we.
Oh, okay. Told the, so that's why. To do, that's why I read. So I read on too much.
Did you finish the chapter? Yeah, I stopped reading after the poem just because it was the 3/4 mark of the book. But I would like to talk about that passage.
Look, we got to save something for the people. We can do it.
Okay, fine.
We can do it next time. That's why I think I emailed you in such a rage, because I didn't have the word that it was at the end of that particular section. I now am recalling that you said that very clearly, but this chapter goes on and on. So I just read to the end of this chapter and I was just infuriated. Like, why do we read so much?
Well, yeah. You sent an email that was, you know, uncharacteristic, I would say, in the level of vitriol for how much this book was causing you to question your life's choices.
Yeah, sorry about that. Anyway, so I'll save all my thoughts until then. But I know stuff that you don't know. I know huge plot points, and I'm.
It is. You're gonna lord this over me all week.
I'm telling you, it takes quite a turn. So
ass piss,
possibly.
The only thing we didn't talk about in this chapter was the sign that Bob. Nailed a board in his yard, which is painted a prostration persuading message of provocation. Uday and Kusei poached precious protected panthers for purient party pictures. And his neighbors were right to be upset about that, clearly. And it sounded to me like he was like just a step away from hopping in a van with Stephen King shot John Lennon conspiracy theories painted all over it, which, you know, Bob, Sean Penn is from California. There's a chance he might've seen that guy.
Oh yeah. He probably is on board with that theory. do you understand what that means at all? through all the annoying alliteration, are you able to get to anything, or is it just for the alliteration?
I don't understand it. No, I assumed it could have been something like those guys, went and there's pictures of, Eric and Donald Trump Jr. with like an elephant they shot. I imagined it could be something like that, going to a game reserve and paying to hunt big game, I would guess. I don't know why that would be the thing that would outrage you about Uday and Qusay Hussein, but, you know,
it might have, as Norm Macdonald would say, I think it's all the killing, you know.
Yeah, they actually probably did have blowtorches to guys' genitals like Bob had feared. But
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I encourage those who haven't even if you have to skip ahead, to just read the section and see if you can do it. The upcoming stuff, because this is the stuff that caused me to, you know, late night send emails to Connor. So that's my little tease for you.
Yeah, well, I think that takes us up to the final part of this section, and we can finish the book for next time. But we do have a few emails to get to.
We're going to the party. We're going to the game. We're going to the disco. We're going to cruise out, man. We're stealing people's mail.
What are the folks out there saying, Connor? Are they loving the book?
They're having some interesting experiences with it. This one is a delightful to me. It's because it's not related to the book. It's more related to the podcast. Sharon wrote in, said that this book has caused me additional trauma because earlier this week I rolled up to the parking attendant's booth and was rolling down my window to swipe my card just as you announced that the next chapter was called Big Cock. So you can only imagine how traumatic that must have been, and her panic explanation to the confused parking attendant might have gone. But sorry about that, Sharon, but that is hilarious.
Oh, that is inopportune.
And then we got another email from Christopher, who sent us it. You might have meant it as fanfic, but obviously you would not have been fooled. But he wrote a passage from his book, Jake Tech, who sky trucks stuff. This is a mashup. The chrome-plated cyber being conspicuously strides purposely and prodigiously upon the vast clear plaz-colored ramps of dopey, dingy, dilapidated downtown Baghdad. His once neighbor Gomez, now just a distant memory, a flight of fancy that flabbergasts the flatulence of boogers and bombs and bovines. With only mild musings, he glances slightly to the right to see a sky car crash unceremoniously into a decrepit dormitory where cold-hearted cyborg contractors from Chihuahua are just beginning their daily routines of showering, shaving, shitting, and shellacking the previous day's grime, grunge, and gook from their pocked, pore-covered pusses. At the same time, to his left, a lovely long-haired librarian takes a swan dive into synergy with the sidewalk below. But alas, gravity and her girth conspire to bring about her exploded ending. As she absquelates from aliveness, he thinks, adios, amiga.
Wow, well done. Tour de force.
It is like a, the best parts of every book combined into one. Well done, Christopher.
That's fantastic.
Those were our two emails. Thank you for sending them in. It's a very pleasure to see how this book has caused you real life misery, but also how it has inspired creativity in some situations.
Well, we're going to have to, we owe our audience a lot after this.
Really?
It's going to take a lot of thought to bring them back into the fold, bring a little lightness into this podcast.
Yeah. And like, so when I was picking fanfic today, I found a passage that I was like, I was in there and it's not going to get that. The darkness is not going away. There's a part in there that I was like, oh man, like this would be a great one just because it would be something to look forward to. But I didn't want to say it out loud. Like,
oh my goodness, really?
It doesn't happen that often. But so we've got that to look forward to next time. I'm imagining it's going to be something we're going to get a lot of emails about. But until then, we can read some dumb sentences.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is big, big, big. A sentence ends.
Don't you wish that guy would set to music some of Sean Penn's prose and sing it? I would listen to the whole book that way if he just sort of vamped his way through it.
The Chimera, Sharded, Patron, Tequila, da-da-da-da-da-da.
Ass piss.
God. All right. Well, so we got some dumb sentences that I don't think we touched on yet. Some of them have commentary provided. Elizabeth, while finding the odd face of wisdom or fury before him, the mining of marbles, dynamic disclosures, mandate, meditative capitulation of consciousness. And so that's him. That's him on the can. But she provided a translation into humanese what Penn was saying. She said it equates to keep an open mind and don't expect straight answers when looking for life advice by staring at your bathroom wall.
So. Yeah, nice. That was the very first one I marked as a dumb sentence. So,
oh wow, nice.
Great minds.
That would be a good feature. It's just his stuff translated into plain English,
yes, like, to human speak.
The next one is from Christopher. Without reputation, only one's body volunteered vulnerability to viciousness. Only one's body. Bob's just a blob. So not blop, but blob.
Yes.
And he said, cue foreigner, I want to know what blob is, and I want Sean to tell me.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So I don't know what that means, but it's another onomatopoeia maybe that he has coined in the course of this book. I got mine. I have two, and I don't know which one is dumber. Okay. While the privileged patronize this pickle as epithet to the epigenetic inequality of equals, Bob smells a cyber-assisted assault emboldened by right-brained Hollywood narcissists.
I had that one marked as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's part of his rant about Hollywood phonies, which I told someone was like, Sean Penn berating people about Hollywood phonies was it was like Holden Caulfield delivering the keynote speech at PhonyCon or something like that.
Right. It's like, yeah, it's a bit much.
The company you keep, man. Like, I understand you probably don't like some of the people you work with, but you lose a certain amount of of the ability to criticize when this is how you've made your career for four decades.
You were on the Kimmel Show just the other night. Come on.
And my other dumb one was, he realizes that not only in road roaming reality has romance been relinquished to ruin, but the cinemas themselves have been caged and quartered into chaotic concrete calamities of corporatized cultural capitulation.
I had that one as well. It's a good thing that I have a lot of them. Yep, I had that too.
Go ahead.
Judge, jury, and journalists had reflexively pre-convicted them of racial rancor by Ruger in a country rife with rule of law.
Yes, from his own realization that maybe the media has played some part in this. Very subtle.
And I have one more. Silly questions of cherries saved Sir... Let me start again. Silly questions of cherries saved served to sever any lasting impression Bob might have had of Spurley as a serious citizen.
Wow. That is she sells she-shells.
Yeah. There. Yeah.
And he did have a sense of Spurley as a serious citizen.
Yeah.
That was something that had been established.
Oh, I can't wait till Spurley's reveal. I assume it's going to be a reveal of who he actually is or...
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about that, just since people kept writing in about the unreliable narrator, whether Spurley exists, whether all this stuff is happening, whether any of that. Do you have any sense of that? Any expectations for where this is going?
I'm going to stick with Spurley is not, it has never existed, is not real or something.
Okay.
So
all right.
I'm going to go with that.
And his wife, do you think she actually has an ice cream empire, or is that...
I don't care.
And is your pool heated?
I don't know if any of this is supposed to be reality at all, so I don't know. I mean,
all right.
You?
Not being able to care makes it so hard, but I would assume... that there's going to be some sort of realization. In the same interview, he talks about like the idea of a sociopath on Jimmy Kimmel. And his whole thesis was like, hey man, the sociopath of 40 years ago is now like the well-adjusted moral guy of society. So I'm guessing though that he acknowledges that Bob is seen by the readers as a sociopath. And so there's a chance he's just been sitting there talking to no one and offering cherries to no one. So wouldn't surprise me, but it wouldn't make me happy either.
Yeah, this it's so weird to imagine that what he thinks this is like a stinging indictment of us all and everyone. You know, it's really hard to convince someone to change their ways or to be more like he wants us to be when he's coming up with terms like ass piss. You know, it's just, yeah, right. I'd listen and maybe if your message was slightly more attractive.
Yeah, I mean, there's been things that he says that are not things that are, you know, hard to disagree with. I mean, Hollywood is full of garbage is certainly one of them. But, you know, you might catch more flies with non-Bob Honey, I suppose, is the way to put that. Like,
yeah, instead of giving us this loaded diaper, why don't you give us one of those nice crispy carapace sandwiches you're enthusing about so much? Put it in that warm, attractive package.
But yeah, so I think that he's whatever he's building to. I mean, we know what he's building to. It's a poem that invokes Louis C.K. and Charlie Rose. So, you know, how we're going to get from A to C there is going to be an interesting thing in these final 40 pages.
So there's high art a coming, folks. So stay tuned for it.
Yeah. Wow. All right. So, yeah, finish the book for next time and send us any final thoughts you might have about the stuff that Bob Honey just did.
All right, yeah, we'll see you next time on 372 pages. We'll never get back.